Welcome back to this week's episode of the Trek Podcast. I'm Fred Lambert, your host, and I'm joined with Seth. How are you doing, Seth?
I'm well, Fred.
Great. This week, we're going to start with, we have a few questions already in the comment section of the YouTube Live. So we're going to address those because we have a few good ones. If you have more, you can leave them down right now and we're going to address them. But Matt asks, has SF Mortar announced how many units they plan on producing? So that's in reference to SF Mortar taking over the former Hummer plant in Indiana. So that happened last year, but they just now took over the plant. The acquisition happened last year. Now they took over the plant and they announced $160 million investment to retool it to produce their all-electric SUVs. And I think it's pretty cool. The SUV looked cool. We don't know much about it instead of just some vague specs and a really early concept vehicle. But it's going to have tech made by Martin Eberhard. And if you remember, Martin Eberhard is the original co-founder of Tesla Motors. So pretty exciting stuff on that front. But in terms of the how many units they plan on producing, they haven't released anything on that. So we would just be speculating. But I don't think it's going to be high volume, because we're talking about $160 million investment, which sounds big, but for the auto industry, it's not. It's just really not that big. We're talking about fewer than 500 employees. So, I mean, unless it's a highly automated production line, I find it hard to believe that it's more like the 10 to 20,000 units per year. I don't know if you have an opinion on that, Seth.
Yeah, I think that even that might be high for the first year.
Yeah.
They've got to start from scratch, I think. You know, remember when Tesla started from scratch, they were making a few thousand per year at most.
Yeah, I think, 5,000 might be more closer, a better ballpark, I think. Beasties38 asks, what do you think of the Porsche Mission E Performance Edition having a rumored 1.90 to 60? I mean, I didn't even know that there was a rumored Porsche Mission E Performance Edition. I know that they were planning three different trims, but I wasn't clear that one would be like a performance one, and certainly not at 1.9 for the 0-60 miles per hour launch. And to me, it doesn't make sense, because Porsche was on record saying, like, criticizing Tesla's insane launch performance, saying that instead they wanted to focus on track performance and be able to go that high power for a longer period of time to get a good racetrack experience for their owners, who are Porsche owners are pretty used to that, so that would make more sense to me. Not about
didn't
you.
Didn't Jaguar engineers mention something about a like they could get it up to 1.9, but it would like it or down to 1.9, but the that much speed in the hands of mere mortals would be dangerous.
Exactly. They did say that this week. I never heard something like that from Porsche. Porsche was more about like the balancing the long period of a high power output versus a short burst. But yeah, it will make sense too. I mean, there's a reason a lot of people are crashing their Tesla. It's because it's a lot of power in the hands of people who just don't know how to use it.
Yeah, and I think Porsche kind of wants to have a better track speed. You know, going around those big like Nuremberg loops. So they probably are more focused on long sustained output. Additionally, I think what we are most interested in from Porsche is their charging speed and, their claimed, ability to charge 240 miles in 15 minutes, which would be pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's the one we need to see to believe it, the acceleration, like we know it's possible. I mean, we've experienced it at the Roadster launch, so it's very possible that Porsche can do it with a much bigger battery pack, so it would be like the higher end version. But again, based on their current comments, I don't see it happening. What else? Do you have any other question? And any news on the Model 3 ramping production after the latest shutdown? The Model 3 production was shut down this week, or for most of the week. We don't have an update yet, but I expect that we're going to have one next week, like early. Normally, like every week or so, we give an early update on production on Monday or Tuesday. We should have that again next week.
And kind of what we were expecting, which was the huge Canadian rollout. I guess this is a good segue into the stories of the week.
Yeah.
We've kind of been thinking that if Tesla had too many cars to put in the U.S. market so that they would, you know, in June they would hit 200,000 and therefore quarter two hit 200,000, which would knock them down a block in the incentives that they would kind of divert more cars to Canada. And it feels like June is Canada month for the Model 3.
Yeah, or at least this week, yeah, for sure.
This week, for sure, yeah.
Yeah, we're talking about 200 units per day that they were trying to deliver in Canada, just in Toronto, in the Toronto region. So they took over the international center near the airport in Toronto, just outside Toronto. And starting on, I think it was Tuesday, at least Wednesday, well, Wednesday and Thursday for sure, but maybe even they started on Tuesday for a few deliveries. They had a few buildings there filled with Model 3 vehicles, and they did the group deliveries. So we talked about last year about Tesla trying to experiment with group deliveries, so having a bunch of people at the same time trying to streamline the delivery process. Because Elon Musk at some point said that he thought that as soon as Tesla figured out production, which they sort of did in the last few weeks with achieving a rate of 3,000 units per week, that the bottleneck would be at actual deliveries, because Tesla doesn't have that many stores and not that many employees at the retail level to do those deliveries. But yeah, so right now they're pretty much experiencing that in Canada. And we reported too that a bunch of Model 3s were sent to Montreal, so not just Toronto. Toronto has the bulk of the deliveries of the volume that's probably going to be in the low thousands after a few weeks. But Montreal got a few dozen units too. And
apparently, we also saw one of our readers tipped us to an Instagram account in Vancouver.
Yeah, Vancouver.
Where there appears to be quite a few Model 3s being delivered.
Yeah, so those are the three big centers right now in Canada. But we also saw a few today in Calgary. So Calgary got a few cars too. But yeah, Ontario and Quebec are going to be the big market also because of a huge incentive of $8,000 for Quebec and $14,000 for Ontario. And some people are afraid that with elections coming up this summer and this fall, this summer in Ontario and this fall in Quebec, that they could go away those incentives. So they're hoping to get the little delivery as soon as possible. But of course, like it's the same problem that you basically have to already have a reservation this year in Canada to be able to get that that Model 3 anyway. So it's just about basically choosing an option that gets you the car sooner. And right now that's the Model 3 rear-wheel drive with a long-range battery pack. Though the all-wheel drive should be coming and the performance version should be coming in the next 12 weeks or so.
Yeah, and the performance editions are going to be the first ones out of the block. And yeah. Which that's one of those things that it's kind of frustrating, but it's par for the course. Tesla, yeah. As they ramp up, you know, the cost structure.
It always been
dictates.
Like that. Always yep. Been like that for Tesla. The performance version always been the first, so it's not a big surprise. But since they started though opening the orders at the same time, I think they're going to be pretty close to deliveries.
Like you should. Yeah, and I don't think that many people are going to pay 70. I mean, if you want a performance car and you have tons of money, you're probably going to get the Model S or X.
Yeah, that too. But I mean, they could just do a production, like in order to streamline production, just do performance production for a full week or just a few days.
Mm-hmm.
And at the current rate, that alone, it's like you work through that backlog of performance order pretty quick. Unless Tesla got like 10,000 orders, for those who don't know, but not impossible, I think. Yeah, but you were just speaking about the cost, so that's a good segue for the. Oh, no, we should talk about the international expansions, and we're just talking about Canada with the Model 3. Elon Musk this week also gave a better timeline on Model 3 deliveries outside of North America, so European markets and Asia. And so originally was about supposed to be mid-2018, and it got pushed to late 2018. And now it looks like European markets are going to see, at least left-hand drive European markets, are going to see the car early next year. So even though you're a Thursday reservation holder, it might add up to actually, like, if it's in March, like, March is still early 2019, right?
Technically. Yeah.
So you could be, someone could have been waiting like 3 years in Europe to get their Model 3 because they could have reserved it on 31st, 2016.
And that's the left-hand drive. Yeah, the right-hand drive's going to be even longer.
yeah, you said mid 2019 for all the ride and drive market, European and Asian market. So that's the UK, that's Japan, that's is Australia? Australia, is it right hand drive or left?
No, it's left. No, it's the same as the UK.
So right hand
drive. And
right.
And Japan is too.
Yeah, Japan.
Ooh,
is
strange for sure.
Not that many market left that are right hand drive.
Yeah, it's weird that we're still doing that.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so what I was saying was about the cost. So that was a big story this week that came out because, well, it was already a big story when the German magazine, don't make me name it.
No.
Wishcraft Book, not sure. They reported on, it's a big magazine though in Germany, and they reported on an engineering firm there that bought a used Model 3 on the used market in the US and brought it to Germany to do a full reverse engineering teardown and benchmark the vehicle. We reported on a few of that in the last few months since the start of multi production. A few of them were done by actual German automakers, like they did with the Model X before and the Model S before that. But with the Model 3, there's a big focus on cost. So they want to know how Tesla is managing to bring the cost down in order to eventually make the car for $35,000. It's not the case right now. But one of those firms talked to that German magazine and said that based on their teardown, they ended up with a material and logistic cost of just $18,000 and a labor cost of $10,000 for a total of $28,000. So we reported
So that's of the base model $35,000 one, which doesn't even really exist yet.
That wasn't clear though. That's the thing. The way they said it is that they think that it can be optimized to $28,000 at a production rate of 10,000 per week. So,
but are they talking about the one that's out with the long range battery?
That's the biggest question. Like, it would make sense since they for sure did a tear down of the long range version, which right. has a 75 kilowatt hour battery pack, so it should be more expensive. But the way I read it, and I'm not German, so I asked a few people, and I look at the translation, and asked a few people that read German, and the way they made it sound, it's more once they get the production 10,000 a unit, and you average it down, the average could be $28,000, which would be pretty impressive because the actual selling price should be like well over 40,000, right? Like the average price once the base battery pack comes out could be like $45,000 average price, like 10,000 over the standard price after you add a few option and you account also for the performance version just dragging the range a lot higher,
right?
So 28,000 would be like a big gross margin. So anyway, we published a report and we were skeptical about it. We said we would take it with a grain of salt because of what we just said basically. But then Elon Musk commented on it and said that he called it the best analysis of the Model 3 so far. So like we said, there were a bunch of other tear down before. And he said that this one was the best. So when he said that, I asked him, like the lead of that report was that the cost could go down to about 28,000 on average at 10,000 units per week. And then Elon responded, definitely. So he definitely thinks that the cost could go down to 28,000 on average. And I think that's a big statement because...
Yeah, I mean, even at 35,000, that's a 20% margin.
Yeah,
you know, just up with the base price.
Yeah. And he did say like 25. The only thing he said before is that he sees a 25% margin achievable for the Model 3, but that's 25% overall.
Yeah.
28,000 average. What does it mean overall? It means like closer to 30, like easily 30, even more than 30. And Model S and X, I've never achieved that yet. So I had a follow-up question to Elon Musk that he didn't respond to.
And what happened there?
Yeah, and I think it made a lot of sense because my question was regarding a battery cost breakthrough. I mean, if what he just said is true, and also linked into the Tesla Semi thing, because as we discussed in the past, the cost of the Tesla Semi and the size of the battery pack in it points to also a big cost improvement for the batteries. And now with this comment too, I'm thinking that Tesla has something in their pocket, like in up their sleeve about the battery cost here. I think it can be like they could be break if 10,000, because supposedly the aim for 10,000 units as soon as next year, right?
Yeah, I mean 5,000 at the end of this quarter, right?
Yeah, and 10,000 sometime in 2019. What else is coming in 2019 from Tesla? The
truck.
Tesla Semi. Yeah, the truck is coming too.
So this report also mentioned that the cobalt content of the batteries was a lot lower than anything they've seen, I think, right? Or they said something like to that effect. So do you think that their cost breakthrough could be related to eliminating cobalt from the equation?
Yeah, we talked about expensive. That with Galileo when he was on. Like, if you, I just don't see that being a big factor. Like, it does make a little difference, but because it looks like there's a significant difference between what Tesla is doing with cobalt and what others. Like, this analyst says 2.8% cobalt in the old battery, and other companies are like at 8%, so it's like almost three times less. But even three times less, it's like going from 12 kilograms per car to 4 kilograms per car. It's like not that big a difference, even though it's expensive. Like, it's a few hundred bucks of difference.
I wonder if that affects the process at all, makes it easier.
That's a good point. So if having less cobalt in the battery cells make the production process easier, that could make a bigger difference. But that's just speculation. I don't know about that at all, though. But it's not impossible for sure.
Yeah, you know, Elon kind of threw water on that. So two things. One, he kind of threw water on the we need some kind of breakthrough to get the economics of the truck to go. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it's a, you know, big breakthrough or just their costs are just coming down and, you know, at such a rate where they know that they can make some very inexpensive batteries. And the second thing is, I forget when it was, but there was a, I feel like it was a earnings call or something where, just like as an aside, he was like, there's no big battery breakthroughs coming at all. Like, we've checked, we've vetted everything and there's nothing out there except this one thing.
Yeah.
That we're not going to talk about. But, you know, it sounded like they had something that, you know, might be interesting. So.
Yeah, but I also tried to make a difference between a big technology breakthrough and a cost breakthrough. Like, a cost breakthrough can not necessarily come with like just a new chemistry or just a new technology coming to market, but just figuring out like a big supply chain issue. If you figure out a big supply chain is a big part of the cost of the batteries. If you figure out a big supply chain improvement or optimization, it makes a big difference on the price. You combine that with material costs, you combine that with the production process, and there's a lot of different things that can come together and create what you could call a battery cost breakthrough, not say a battery technology breakthrough. So even though, yeah, it did definitely throw cold water on the battery tech breakthrough, I'm still thinking that the battery cost breakthrough could be the answer to our mini question about the Model 3 cost and also the Tesla Semi cost.
Yeah, and of course, the economics of scale, like that Gigafactory is the biggest battery factor on Earth, or battery factory on Earth, and it sounds like right now it's not running as smoothly as it could be, but it seems like they're on their way there, and as automation kind of, you know, takes human beings and out of the equation and speeds things up, you know, all of a sudden the labor costs go way down, and, you know, the per kilowatt hour battery price is going to continue to drop pretty rapidly.
Yeah, and also that everything you said applies to both the battery cell and the battery pack too. So like Panasonic could be making improvements to the manufacturing process on the battery cells, then Tesla could make advancement to the battery module or the whole battery pack, and when you combine those, like the goal is to reduce the cost per kilowatt hour of the whole battery pack. There's like 10,000 things that you can improve in that. So, and if you approach it with like the first principle that Tesla's approach it with the first principle way, I'm sure there can be some surprises there. But speaking of cost, about the cost of insurance, that's not fun.
No, not at all.
No, and especially not for Tesla vehicles. As this week, the Model S in the U.S. topped the list of the most expensive vehicle to insure. And what was the price? Sorry, I'm not finding it right. Okay. With an annual, so that was based on the Insurance Institute of Highway Safety. that gathered a bunch of, it's an insurance company group in the U.S., a non-for-profit insurance company group, that gathers the data. Then 24/7 Wall Street put an analyst together to have a list of the 25 most expensive vehicles, and the Model S topped it with an annual average insurance paid of $1,789 and an annual collision insurance paid of $1,310. So
that's, you add those two up and you get like $3,000?
Well,
or is that does that work?
Well, the insurance is cost of $1,700. That's what the average people pay in the U.S. for the Model S. Then the collision insurance paid, I assume that's like
the
minimum.
So that's the payouts.
Yeah, the minimum payout, the average payout that people get annually for the Model S.
Well, that's nice. The insurance companies make $400 per person.
Yeah.
$460, $470 bucks per person. That's not too bad.
Yeah, it's pretty profitable, I think. It's insurance, if it's done.
You know
right,
what? Tesla should get into the insurance game.
Yeah.
They can make some money.
You know what? You know what? We should look into that, though, since we have a lot of people in electric readers are also Tesla owners. What I heard is that in Norway, they banded together to get a deal on the insurance. They reach out to a company and just sort of a group buy thing, if you will. And apparently they got that down to like $600 per on average. The equivalent US $600, which is a third of that. So a very big difference.
You know, it's kind of interesting. So, you know, the idea of Tesla getting into insurance. Tesla can do a lot of things that a normal insurance company can't, which, you know, obviously is controversial. But, you know, they could charge you insurance based on your mileage, for instance. You know, they have access to how many miles you drive, how many highway miles you drive versus city miles. You know, what kind of areas you drive in. Are they dangerous areas? So they could give you a very fine-grained cost structure, which would theoretically save more people money because there's less risk for Tesla or the insurance company. So it's kind of interesting that with a car company becoming a insurance carrier, there's a lot of things that Tesla can do. And clearly, you know, they have access to the log. So, and we know how that works. So if, you know, you say, well, I don't know, autopilot was on. I don't know why
that's the bigger thing, I think.
Right.
If no one can lie on the insurance claim, there's still room to, if you want to do something. But I think that's the bigger difference. But what you just said, though, insurance companies are starting to do it with some mobile apps, though. I know my insurer offers that. If you download the mobile app and they track you and everything, so it's not... It's a bit shady to have the insurer tracking you all the time, but if Tesla can already do it with your car, might as well do it for your insurance.
Right.
It looks like Tesla's insurance effort is expanding, really. So we reported that back almost 2 years ago when it started in Australia and in Hong Kong. Now we reported earlier this year that it expanded to the U.S. and North America. And they just hired a new head of that program for North America, Alex Tsisenikos.
Hard names today.
Yeah, another hard name for me. What's interesting is that the guy is coming, well, he's been with a bunch of different insurance company, especially in the digital department, trying to digitalize insurance. But he was also a former executive at Liberty Mutual, which is a Tesla's partner for the Insure My Tesla program in the US. So there's a looks like the right person to be in charge of that program. And how we learned about that is that he's actually going to be at a conference later this year in October, and they sent out a press release for it, and the actual keynote presentation title is Building a Customer-Centric Insurance Company for Tesla. It looks like they want like no paperwork, or at least only digitalized paperwork, a streamlined experience for the customer.
Yeah, and insurance is already a pain in the backside, so anything that they can do to smooth that process would be nice. Also, like, just saying insurance conferences sound like the most boring thing I can
think of. It's not even an insurance conference. That's a thing, too. That's why I was surprised to see it there, guys. No, it's for it's Utility Dive, which is oh, now they removed the thing. Oh,
yeah, I was just going to it.
Yeah, they removed the link to it, so maybe they send that out a little bit too early, maybe. Or you shouldn't have been saying those stuff in the press release. I was surprised, because it was weird, like, a few months ahead, but I checked with Tesla, and they didn't deny anything that was in the PR release, so it should be all right. It was something about the electric utilities, so a weird one. But speaking of new hires at Tesla, Tesla did a weird thing the past few weeks. They announced a bunch of new hires, something that they don't usually do for anyone outside of like C-level employees, executives. But in the past week, they sent out two blog posts about hiring a bunch of new execs. And it seems to be like in response to all the reports in the past few months of people leaving the company, and those reports are always framed as Tesla has a big turnover rate, something that's, they never say it's unusual for Silicon Valley, because it's just not. It's pretty standard there, but the article make it sounds like it. And so it, since Tesla doesn't usually do that, like either we report a new somewhat high profile hire, or it just goes under the radar completely. They don't normally announce that.
Maybe they're trying to scoop us instead of us breaking the news. They're just trying, they're like giving up. I'm like, all right, we might as well just announce it.
I mean, just I use Jim Keller in their article for an example. Jim Keller is probably Tesla's biggest hire ever, like most high profile hire ever. Sorry about that. Most high profile hire ever. And they weren't the one to announce it. Like, we had to reveal it like a month later or something like that. So the fact that they didn't announce that, but now they announced, what did they announce? They announced Stuart Bowers was VP of engineering. So that was the biggest one last week. A guy from Snap, machine learning expert that worked at Facebook and Snap. They announced a new director of energy manufacturing. So all of Tesla's energy product. His name is Neeraj Manohar from Apple. That the guy was leading a technological operation team at Apple. What else? What, our new director of production engineering at the Gigafactory. So probably going to work with, I forget his name, but the VP of Gigafactory. There's a former guy from Lego, was building the Lego blocks. This guy is coming from Thin Film Electronics. So that's a semiconductor company, I think, Thin Films.
Yep.
Semiconductor company. A new CFO in China for a Tesla company. Of course, Tesla is growing like crazy in China, so they need a bigger leadership team there. So now they have James Zhu as CFO.
Do we know when Tesla's going to roll the Model 3 out to China? I can't remember if we had that number.
Well, as we talked about earlier about Tesla's international expansion, that includes Europe and Asia. So I sort of put China in there. And I mean, it was a good question that they could launch in China sooner, because like in the past few weeks they have been holding sort of a showcases event with the Model 3. Like they go in malls and they do their pop up store in malls, which they used to do with the Model S and X, but now they did it with the Model 3. Maybe like a full year ahead of a full year ahead of the actual launch. So that sounds kind of weird, but at the same time. And also people are thinking, since Tesla is planning a manufacturing facility in China, are they going to wait to produce their own Model 3 in China? Which sounds risky, because it could be like 2 or 3 years away at this point.
Right, but it would save them quite a bit of money.
Yeah, for sure.
What is the tax rate now? It was 25%, and it got lowered recently to 10 or 15?
15, I think, yeah.
Okay.
A bunch of other people, senior director of government affairs, so field delivery operations, director of logistic operation, regional sales director for Europe and the Middle East. So some pretty significant hires, but nothing too high profile. Coming a lot from Amazon, I think. Like a bunch of them were from Amazon. A bunch of them from GM, BMW.
Yeah, Apple. They all seem to be like name brand hires instead of hiring, you know, somebody out of college or somebody from some company, logistics company you've never heard of.
Yeah, but they're all they're all directors anyway, so it's, you know, it's pretty people with more experience. That was a few days, like early this week or even like last Friday, maybe. And now today, yesterday, when was that? The 31st. That was yesterday. They announced two other hires, a little bit higher up this time too. Sanjay Shah is going to be Tesla's new senior VP of energy operations. So SVP, that's pretty like the highest level that you can have aside from a C-level employees, which Tesla doesn't have many of. So he's going to take over the energy operation. He's coming from Dell. Sanjay was coming from Amazon too. So he was working at Dell, then Amazon again. So that's a few from Amazon that came out. So a big logistic guy from Amazon and his American fulfillment centers. And he's going to be replacing, that's a pretty big loss for Tesla though, Cal Langton. Cal Langton has been an executive at Tesla for a long time. He started out by managing Tesla supercharger network. So from very beginning, I think, or maybe 2013. So either the very beginning or like a few months into the program, he started managing the supercharger network. Was coming from ABB. ABB is also, of course, a big manufacturer of charging station. And over the past few years, his role has expanded at Tesla. Most recently, he took over energy the energy operation from what's his face, Lyndon Rive, Elon Musk's cousin, who was of course co-founder and CEO of SolarCity. When Tesla acquired SolarCity, he took over the leadership of Tesla's energy division. When he left last year, Carl Langton took over, and now Carl is apparently going away. He's going to depart from Tesla, and Shah is taking over.
So moving up the chain a little bit, Tesla's having some issues getting its board members approved.
There's at least some pushback.
Yeah, some pushback.
The issue's going to happen next week or not. Yeah, we don't know.
Usually these things go through pretty smoothly, but, you know, James Murdoch as you know, connected to Fox News, very conservative, very climate denying entity, kind of a weird choice to be on Tesla's board. And then I believe also Elon's brother, Kimball, is facing some controversy, not because of anything he's done or, you know, his career, but because his relationship to Elon.
Yeah, well, Kimball is not like the three of them are. I think the biggest issue with because the only like it's the CW Investment Group that has the biggest issue. They're the one like trying to get some press about this stuff to try to get them off the board with the re-election next Tuesday. Because next Tuesday is a shareholder meeting. That's why we're talking about this. Next Tuesday, actually, Tesla just tweeted about it because they want question. If you have any question, you can go to Tesla's Twitter and a question for Elon Musk. I mean, and they're gonna try to answer them next Tuesday. But before that Q&A, there's gonna be the re-election of the three board members that you just mentioned: Kimball, Musk, Antonio Gracias, and. And yeah, James Murdoch. But I read a bunch of their stuff. They are all over the place with this. And the main issue seems to be that they don't have any experience with automakers. And so they want people like independent. They're planning that they're not independent of Elon Musk, which I don't think you can say that of James Murdoch, but you can definitely say it of Kimball Musk, of course, with his brothers. And Antonio Gracias, who has a bunch of investment with Elon.
Yeah, and you know, actually, I heard on a Tim Ferriss podcast yesterday, which was really good, with Jurvetson, who, you know, quite a bit of interesting stuff there. But there was an anecdote about Antonio Gracias. Basically, you know, when in 2008, when everything was kind of falling apart, he was like the one guy who, you know, had some money and was helping Elon out, kind of getting Tesla in order. So I think there's a very close relationship there.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know that they are definitely independent, but I know that they work quite well together. So, you know, if I'm a Tesla shareholder, which I'm currently not, I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. You know, I don't know what the CTW investment group's motives are really, but you know, I do have a problem with James Murdoch.
Other people have, I think.
Yeah, I don't think it's really. I actually just, I'm curious, like, what the thinking is behind, you know, of all the people to pick on the planet, why pick a, you know, ultra conservative, climate denying.
Apparently he's not. That's the thing. Apparently James Murdoch is like the black sheep of the family, and he's very liberal and is very pro environmentalist and all that stuff. So that's what I hear. I've never met the guy.
Right.
I never even seen much of a like decent interview of him, other than like just sound bites and stuff like that. So really not have a big opinion on him. But yeah, the logic behind it, like that's what I don't get. Because if you want someone from the media industry, which that alone is a stretch for running an automaker and a technology company, the other person that they brought on board, Johnson, the woman, is also from the media industry. So if your goal was to have someone from the media industry, like you bring two at a time, sound weird. But anyway, I'm pretty curious, because I think it's going to go through anyway. I think like most people just vote with the board, and the board is, of course, recommending that all three be reelected. I don't think Gracias and Antonio Gracias and Kimball Musk are going to have any issue. Even though they don't have any like experience in the auto industry, they have been with the board on Tesla's board since almost the very beginning. So I mean, that alone is pretty much a lot of experience in the industry. Like they've been at it for over 10 years. So, and during those 10 years, even though Tesla has had his issues, they've been doing pretty well right now. So if you don't fix it, it ain't broke, right?
Right.
But yeah, I'm gonna be curious to see if someone doesn't go through, it's gonna be Murdoch. But again, I'm gonna be surprised if it doesn't go through. Moving on from Tesla, the oil industry finally starting to get somewhat of being affected by Norway's rapid electric vehicle adoption. So, of course, as you know, Norway is being pretty advanced in terms of electric vehicle adoption, with now they are often, I think, over 50% of new cars being electric, which is pretty amazing. And so it gives us sort of like a glimpse into the future of other bigger markets, because I mean, like, if you start talking about the U.S., like, when is the U.S. going to be at 50%? It could be, like, easily, like, a decade away. So it would give us, like, a pretty good idea of how a market evolve with a higher adoption rate of electric vehicles.
And well, you know what? I recently did that story on the Kona in Norway, and I was looking back in Norway, and we have stories where, like, Norway's at 30%, at 40%, at 50%. And this is all within, like, 2 or 3 years. So I think there's a tipping point. I think Norway's beyond the tipping point, and we're watching what happens when the tipping point, you know, falls over, and lo and behold, the oil industry starts to cave in.
Yeah, starts to cave in. It's a big way to put it. What they are seeing is that, because like you said, it's been like a few years now, like the 20-30%, like 2 years ago they were already hitting that, now they're hitting 50%. So there was a big, it's pretty short period of time too. Like we're starting since the Tesla arrived on the market, since the Leaf arrived on the market, that's when like the big numbers started coming in. Since that was over just the last 4 years, but all over that period of time, the gasoline and diesel sales were actually increasing in Norway. So even though EVs were the adoption rate was going up fast, the overall market was growing also fast, so it compensated for EVs, and therefore gasoline and diesel sales were still going up. But the new numbers for 2017 just came out, and for the first time in 2017, for the first time since that EV revolution that we're calling it, it declined by 2.9% for gasoline and 2.7% for diesel. So not a huge decline, but a pretty significant one if you account for all those years before where it was going up, even though EVs were going on the market quite fast. So the first sign of the oil industry being affected.
Right. And you know, the big irony, obviously, is Norway gets a lot of its money from its oil reserves, you know, down the water. So it's kind of funny that, hey, Norway might be kind of hurting themselves, but there's plenty of people using oil and will be for quite a bit of time.
Yeah, that's the thing. The oil, the petroleum products, till when overall petroleum, other petroleum, like EV fuel, oil, jet kerosene, and other petroleum products all went higher. So the only thing that went down was diesel and gasoline, but that's enough to have an overall decline too. So even though everything else went up, just the fact that gasoline and diesel went down affects the entire oil industry pretty significantly. So.
Yeah, and I think that's like the way, by far, the way two biggest uses of petroleum is for the car products.
Yeah, for sure. So, and that 50% is going to be affected a lot more with new EVs coming to market. So, of course, when the Model 3 is going to arrive, it's going to be a big difference. But a few other cars are going to arrive in the market before the Model 3 in Norway. And one of those cars is going to be the Audi e-tron Quattro. And we had a big article on it this week because Audi put it in the wind tunnel and sent out a bunch of stats on it. And a few interesting things. First off, Audi made a big thing about the drag coefficient of the e-tron Quattro when it came out in 2015. They claimed that it was the most drag efficient aero, the highest aero performance of any SUV on the market, with a 2.5, they said, I think originally 2.4 was the 2.5, they said, 0.25, yeah, 0.25 drag coefficient, which was the best at the time for sure. But then, like, 2 weeks later, Tesla came out with a Model X, and they claim a 0.24 drag coefficient. But that was the production version of the Model X versus the original concept of the e-tron Quattro. So this week they have like the latest production prototype, because the production vehicle is like coming out in a few months. So if it's not the production vehicle, it's like very, very close to the like, it's a beta prototype or a pre-production prototype, if you will. And this one got a 0.28, so very not as good as the original one. Like,
it seems like that grill on the front might be
like made the difference.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not super good at that. I do know that electric cars have like an incredible advantage because the bottom of the car is flat, mm-hmm. or typically flat. So you know, you don't have the whole like exhaust system down there, and you know, other stuff kind of blocking the air. And then, you know, obviously regular internal combustion engines require a lot of cooling, so yeah, that they push a lot of the air into the engine rather than around the car. So, you know, that's an obvious advantage as well.
Yeah, for sure. And the other big advantage of the e-tron Quattro is the mirrors, which are non-existent. at least for that product pre-production version that they put in the wind tunnel, they put one with the cameras instead of the exterior mirrors on it, which of course make a big difference for the drag coefficient, since the surface of it is like three times smaller or something like that. And they made it sound like it's going to be an option. It's going to be available as an option. And we know that a few markets are starting like to explore it. I think it's legal in Japan right now. Maybe a few markets in Europe are going to be able to allow it. Though normally in Europe they make it like a whole continent wide thing, not just a per country thing. But I don't think it's yet legal in the US. Though there was some discussions about it, but I don't think it's going through in the near future. So it sounds like it's going to be available and an option if it's legal in your own market.
Yeah, and you know, obviously Tesla's been playing around with that. The original Model X had cameras instead of rear view mirrors, prototype, and then also the new Tesla semis they came out with cameras instead of mirrors, but I think later on, to make them street legal, mirrors were put on them.
Yeah, the unveiling, they had cameras. Now the sighting that we see in the wild is has those side mirrors. But yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I mean, even then, like, people were, there are a lot of people that just don't use their mirrors anyways.
Right.
Might as well put cameras in there, and it's going to be better for those people at least.
Yeah, I mean, and if you've ever stuck your hand out the window with going 60 miles per hour, you know that it's pretty serious pull, you know, and that's basically sitting on your car all the time.
Yeah, definitely.
So it's a big difference.
Yeah, and I mean, and the technology works so well now too. Like, very rare that I have any issue with my backup camera. Very rare. Of course, it can get dirty, but so does a mirror. So it's not a big difference. And, I'm interested to see what's going to happen with that. And of course, the RD Twin Quattro is supposed to launch later this year. People are talking about the price, close to $80,000, something like that. We're not exactly sure yet. The price was just in Germany so far, and they said 80,000 euros, but that's with the taxes, so closer to 67,000 euros, which would bring it close to 78,000, 80,000.
I think so, 70 to 80,000 would be probably, you know, a good place to guess, especially with the Jaguar similarly priced. Audi's kind of a premium brand, so they're not gonna surprise us with a, you know, Kona $40,000.
No, they won't, but they should.
Yeah, it would be nice.
Yeah, it's not that big of an SUV too, so it's smaller than the Model X, and it's gonna be priced pretty close to it. Though it looks more like a traditional SUV, and that alone, I think, is gonna attract a market, a different type of buyers than the Model X. A lot of people don't like the design of the Model X. They just don't.
Yeah, and it looks like there's some more ground clearance, so maybe it can go in the dirt a little bit more.
Yeah, it might be. Yeah, like the Model X, it has air suspension that you adjust with depending on the speed, too, so you can get more ground clearance, and when you are on the highway, it goes down, and you get better drag coefficient, too. Moving on to GM. What's up with GM this week? Autonomous driving space. They make it. They themselves put out a lot of money, and they also got a new partner in SoftBank to put a ton of cash into GM Cruise, which is the autonomous division that was born out of GM's acquisition of Cruise Automation, a small startup that was working on electric vehicles. They were was started by Kyle Vogt, who was, of course, the co-founder of Twitch, the streaming service. And it has, at least at the time, it had a bunch of former Tesla Autopilot engineers in there. And they were acquired for a cool $1 billion from GM. That was back in 2016. Since then, we've reported a bunch of time on their effort with the Bolt EV prototype. Like, they made a fully autonomous Bolt EV, basically. And a few impressive videos came out where it looks like they had some decent technology in there. Of course, it's like geofence in San Francisco and Arizona, and now in Michigan too. Like over 100 prototypes driving around, but they want to expand that a lot. They are, I think, they feel a lot of competition with Waymo, because they don't want a similar service as Waymo, but of course adapted just to GM's vehicle instead of Waymo going with Chrysler and with Jaguar and so on. But the service is the same. Like, they want the captive fleet, so it's their home fleet of vehicle offering a ride sharing service, ride hailing service that is driverless. And to get that to market as soon as next year, they put up another $1 billion into the company, and they got SoftBank to invest 2.25 billion, mm-hmm. Starting with $900 million. And they think that $900 million and GM's $1.1 billion, so a total of $2 billion, is going to be enough to bring that technology to market next year. And as soon as it's ready for commercialization, SoftBank is going to put the rest of their 2.2 to just accelerate that in a big way. So, I mean, if you think about it, once you're on the market with it, once you're ready to go to market, you have the production ready to have those cars, like $1 billion, like $1.35 billion.
It's also interesting.
A lot of cars, like, ton of cars.
You know that SoftBank's putting $2.25 billion into the venture, and at the end of that, that gives them 20% of GM Cruise. So that kind of values GM Cruise at about $11 billion, which is pretty big, valuation for
a ton of money right now in those startups. It's
right. It's a ton of money, but still it's a lot of money.
Yeah.
For something that's kind of unproven.
Yeah, and okay, because what is it, right? It's 100 or so prototype, like maybe 200 at this point,
right?
And the software and those prototypes. That's basically it. I mean, there's
a bunch of engineers running around.
Yeah, the engineer that did those.
But those guys are like coming and going pretty quickly.
Oh yeah, they're getting offers everywhere, every time. Like as soon as they put out their CV somewhere, it's they get a ton of offer because it's just turnover is insane right now in those startups. Well, I'm calling it a startup, but like it's pretty much a division of GM at this point, a subsidiary of GM, we should say. BMW this week had also a few news in the EV world, starting with a major, I'm quoting here, major increase in capacity at their battery factory in China. So GM has its own battery factory in China under their joint venture called BMW Brilliance Automotive. And they already started making batteries for their plug-in hybrids in China. But now they are going to double that production to support the upcoming BMW iX3. So we're pretty excited about the iX3. Apparently it's going to be somewhat affordable, and it's going to be another vehicle that's going to compete with the Audi e-tron Quattro and all those SUVs coming to market, electric SUVs. And they aim to start a production in China first. So I'm not clear on that, because I think they're going to start production in China and Germany, then they want to export the car. I'm not sure if they're going to export the car from China, though, because that's what Volvo wants to do with their first EV. So I know that some international automakers are going to try to do some export from EVs produced in China. I'm not sure if it's going to be the case from the iX3, but they're going to have some decent production for it. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah, I mean, I think there'd be quite a bit of demand for it. You know, BMW's got a little bit of electric in their
lineup.
Yeah, but you know, basically it's the i3 at this point, which they haven't really upgraded significantly. And then a whole bunch of their cars have like about 10 miles of electric before they switch over to gas.
Yeah.
So, you know, having a full EV would be quite a big deal. Yep. Especially in a segment, you know, the i3 is kind of it's a strange car, strange looking car. A lot of people love the look and the design. I think it's pretty neat, but
a lot.
You know, what's that?
A lot. Yeah. Show me some source on that.
Yeah. Well, a few people like it. I actually think it's not a bad design. The suicide doors aren't really convenient if you're dropping your kids off or something, but, you know, it's an interesting car. At least they made it. It has goofy tires that are, you know, look like they belong on motorcycles. So it's quirky. This car, this SUV, seems like way more mainstream. It looks like a, you know, SUV. It's got some interesting wheels, but other than that, it looks like it could be just a regular, ICE BMW. So I think, hey, let's try not selling a weird mobile with electric and see how it does. I think it'll do quite well.
Yeah. Like, can you hear me right now? Because I think I lagged out for a moment. Can you hear me, Seth?
Yeah, I just lost you for a second. I lost you. Are you back? So we lost Fred. So I think we'll go to the next... The next story is also about BMW and their wireless charging.
Can you hear me right now?
Yeah, you're back.
Yeah, I'm back. All right, sorry about that. I lagged out for a moment. Pretty much have too much article too open much, at the same time.
Too much Ambien?
Too much Ambien, no. Too much article open at the same time on my browser, I think. But yeah, you were just talking about BMW's... plug-in hybrids that now have really short range, nothing too impressive. And one of those is going to get the wireless charging option. So it sounds like it's going to be expanded to all of BMW's electric lineup. But right now it's only with the BMW 530e plug-in hybrid, like we said. And that was announced last year, the BMW wireless charging system. But now it's going out in production, and you can order it with the vehicle starting now in Germany and soon in the US, Japan, and China. It's a 3.2 kilowatt system that gets the chargers get installed in the factory when you order with the option. And then you get the ground pad that you can have installed in your garage or also outside or pretty much anywhere. And you just have to park on top of it, and it's going to start charging at up to 3.2 kilowatts. And that's the bummer. An efficiency rate of 85%, which is 5 to 10% lower than a plugged-in system.
Yeah, and I wonder if that's 85% of that, or if it's 85% of just, you know, off the wall.
I think it's off the wall.
Yeah, either way, it's not great. And 3.2 kilowatts is not fast charging at all.
Nope.
You know, let do easy math. If you're getting 3.2 kilowatt and you do that for 10 hours overnight, that gives you 32 kilowatts of charge, which is about half of a Chevy Bolt. So you could charge your Chevy Bolt half overnight, which, you know, that's not great. You know, bigger batteries will even, you know, I'm assuming the BMW SUV is going to have probably, you know, 75. So you're talking about 3 nights or, you know, 30 hours.
If you're on this to zero.
Yeah, if you're down to zero, to go from zero to full. So, you know, I don't know what this pad is actually for. I guess maybe, you know, those same people who are, you know, excited about getting 10 miles of electric range will be excited about not having to plug in, which takes, you know, less than 30 seconds. So I don't know. I don't
less
quite
than
get the
5 seconds.
Yeah, I don't know what this is for. I think the people who have never plugged in before are like, oh, you know, like, what do you have to do? You have to, like, you open the thing, and then you got get the thing off the wall, and you got to look at it, and what, you know, it takes a while to do all this stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, I literally almost don't even stop walking. Like, you know, I'll be walking by it, and I'll be like, you know, and
so I don't know what time at all. It's a lazy thing to.
People are doing it with cell phones, so.
Yeah, but it's a lazy thing for the owner, but I think it's lazy from BMW or for the retail's perspective of it. Because when you take into account the efficiency loss on top of it, then it makes no sense at all. Like, because it's a convenient thing. Okay, for sure, it's a little bit more convenient than a plug-in, like a very little bit. So the only way I see that people are trying to sell that, so if you at the dealership, you go buy an electric BMW, then you start talking about charging, and the salesman sees that there's some frictions in terms of charging, the charging experience. So they try to sell that instead. They say, oh, well, you can have like $3,000. You can have the option to not plug it at all and just go wireless. And then they say, oh, okay, I'm going to go do that. Like, if you're rich people buying a BMW 5 Series, like, it can make sense for you. But when he does that, though, the salesman, does he explain that you get a higher efficiency loss, which means that you spend more electricity to charge your car and lose more electricity, which, of course, is another costing. Maybe they don't mind about the costing, but then it's also an environment thing. You consume more energy that you don't even end up using, really.
Yeah, it's probably lost his heat or something.
Yeah, so I wonder. Explain that? I don't think they will.
I wonder if you can charge both, like if you can be on a pad and plug in at the same time.
And get more charging, you mean? Like,
yeah,
to like a faster
double
rate?
Yeah, whatever.
I don't know, if it's used, because that's an AC charger, so it used the onboard charger. So I'm pretty sure it's
AC? Okay.
Yeah, it's going to use the same charger, I think, right?
I don't know. I didn't look into it too much. It's a good question.
Yeah, so I don't think they can charge both at the same time.
All right, should we move on to the Hyundai Kona?
Yeah, that was your pulse this week.
So. Yeah, so this is a product car that I'm actually a little excited about, and I hope we get to review because it is a economical SUV-ish type of, you know, more of a crossover type of car, but it doesn't cost 70,000 or 80,000 like the Audi and the Jaguar and the Model X do, it costs 40,000 with or less, depending on the conversion rate from Norway. So the news was that Norway got prices and 325,900, which is basically, but this is for the 64 kilowatt hour version, and base model. So this is not with leather or sunroof or any of the options they have, but still that equates to under $40,000. And that's the big battery pack. And we know that, Hyundai was going to offer a 40 kilowatt hour battery pack. So theoretically, even if it goes 1-to-1 price in the U.S., which, you know, oftentimes in the U.S. it's a little bit less expensive. If they do that, then we're looking at, you know, mid to low 30s $1,000 car SUV, and with a, you know, quite large battery. Well, you know, 40 kilowatt hour, not huge. But we also know that Hyundai is very good at getting a lot of mileage per kilowatt. So, you know, my estimate on the back of the napkin was about 166 miles for the low range version. And they are saying, strangely, close to 300 miles using the NEDC in Europe, but they're saying 250 using our EPA estimate. So somewhere, I think 250 is probably a safer bet. So pretty compelling car. It doesn't look horrible. I mean, the inside certainly looks pretty nice, I think. Not, you know, probably not my cup of tea, but certainly this looks a lot like a nice higher-end U.S. car. And, you know, the outside, it seems like they've taken some time to make, you know, the wheels look pretty nice. The shape's pretty good. You know, they sell the Kona in an ICE version. So the kind of like the Ioniq, where they have the hybrid and the fully electric version.
Yeah, that's my problem with this.
Yeah.
It's because there is a Hyzer version too that's going to be a lot cheaper. It's going to end up a lot like the Ioniq. So it's a good car and everything, but they're going to produce like low volume.
Yep.
And people are only going to buy it where there's incentive to it too.
Right. The Kona is going to be in California.
Yeah, it's going to be in California. It's going to be in those market. It's going to be in Europe. But other than that, it's going to be hard to get your hands on it because, like, how much is the Kona? I think the Kona isn't even 20,000, right? Like, it starts at?
I think it's around 20,000, yeah.
Yeah, 20,000. So if this one started at 40, well, or like 35 or something for the base version, like, most people, like, if you're looking for an electric vehicle, yeah, for sure, that's going to be great because there's just not that many options in that segment for a long-range vehicle. But for converting people to electric, if they go to the dealership and they have a Kona, a Hyzer Kona at $20,000 and an EV Kona at $40,000, it's going to be a tough sell. So if there's an incentive, like a $8,000 or more, something like that, that starts to make sense. Other than that, I think it's not going to be a huge impact on the overall EV adoption, I think.
Well, it's unfortunate because the Ioniq that Hyundai made was quite a good car, although one of our writers, Jordan, his had an issue that the dealers weren't very good at fixing, although I think he since got it fixed. Anyway, I test drove it. I thought it was a great base level car. You know, my car a couple years ago was a Prius. And the Ioniq kind of compares pretty well to the Prius. But, you know, it had CarPlay and Android Auto, and it had, you know, a lot of nice features, and it's the most efficient electric vehicle still to this day on the market at 136 miles per gallon E. So, like, Hyundai can make a good electric car. It's just, like, somewhere between the engineering and the selling of it, you know, something gets lost. And, you know, we know that people are lining up to get the Ioniq EV, and they just can't make enough of them. They don't even have the battery supply chain to make enough of these things. So, you know, it is kind of unfortunate, but, you know, if you work hard and you kind of drill down your Hyundai dealer, you may be able to get one of these for $35,000 and then, you know, $7,500 off of that and whatever state incentives. So you're talking about like a $25,000, you know, in California and New York and stuff.
And California, you also have the subscription thing, I think, which also could be, if the mileage that is, unable, if they allow the mileage that works with your commute and your daily driving, I think there are some good deals there too.
Yeah. And also, additionally, this one charges a little quicker than the, Ioniq. It also has a lot more power, not a ton more speed. Like I think the 0 to 60 is like 7.5 seconds. So it's a little bit more, I mean, the interior looks a little bit nicer. It's a little bit more premium than the Ioniq. But you know, the out the door price, approaching $25,000 for that car, not bad.
Yeah, yeah, definitely something to think about. But again, I'm curious to see when it actually comes out, the availability of it in the markets. We're going to check. We're going to let you go this week with a quick mention of Waymo. We talked about GM Cruise. I think it's going to be the big competitor to Waymo right now. And big order of Chrysler Pacifica hybrid minivans. Not necessarily that. They did say Pacifica, but right now they're using hybrid, so we assume that they still want hybrid. But the fleet is up to 62,000 more. So big fleet of all electric vehicles they're looking to convert. And that follows the 20,000 or so order for the Jaguar Hi-Pace too. So the
right, so you're coming up on 100,000 vehicles.
Yeah, 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 for sure. And they already, that's on top of the previous order of a few thousands that they did earlier this year, which should start being delivered by the end of the year. And of course, the thing is, where are they going to come from, those Pacifica hybrids, if they're still going with the hybrids? Because it's apparently very hard to get your hands on a Pacifica hybrid right now. So maybe they're just all going to Google and that's it. Waymo, I should say. So yeah, it's going to be interesting. And it looks like if they're sticking with the hybrid version, which is actually a plug-in hybrid version, the Pacifica Chrysler likes to call it just a hybrid. It looks like at least Waymo is going electric with their autonomous vehicles. So
it does seem like Google's going there, and I think Google's smart and they know where the market's going to be in 3 to 5 years. So good for them.
Yeah, and good for everyone. 62,000 more partially electric vehicles on the road.
Yeah, and 20,000 Jaguar. So
yeah, the Jaguar going to be crazy too. And that could come out in Phoenix as soon as the, not those 60,000, of course, but a few thousand of those and the Jaguar in Phoenix by the end of the year. It should be an announcement for that in the coming months from Waymo. And that's going to be it for us this week. Guys, thanks a lot for listening live on YouTube and watching after the fact and audio version on your podcast app too. You can leave a review, leave a comment, leave some feedback. We really appreciate it. Also, we have our Patreon, patreon.com/electric. If you contribute there, that helps Electric a lot, both the podcast and the blog. And we're going to see you next week. Bye-bye.